Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Charles Derber. Charlie is Boston College Professor of Sociology. He's a leading social critic. He challenges corporate power, globalization injustice, and imperial lawlessness. His books include Regime Change Begins at Home, Corporate Nation, The Wilding of America, and People Before Profit. He's written a lot more besides that. Charlie also lives in Boston. He's been on the front lines, so to speak, of what's been going on there all week. It certainly kept me busy writing about it. And Charlie, I'm certain it's kept you busy watching events and seeing the horrors that are going on. Imagine Boston being locked down, Charlie. I live there. I grew up there. I simply can't imagine anything like that, but it happened last week.
Hi, Stephen. Well, you know, I've been giving some thought to the lockdown and really surprised that there's been so little commentary about what it means to lock down a city. I mean, the feeling, of course, has been self-congratulatory that the two, you know, suspects were caught and things seem to be resolved. But, of course, when you think about it, the lockdown was lifted on, an hour or two before the second suspect was caught. And I think all of the cheering, you know, as soon as the younger brother was taken into custody, very badly injured in a hospital, right now, too sick to talk. People were running around yelling USA, USA, and so forth. So while there was, you know, heroism and resiliency in the city, there wasn't a tremendous amount of, things that you saw right after 9/11. You know, immediate sort of denunciation of Muslims and all that sort of thing. I've been thinking, I'm sure you have, about the meaning of locking down an entire city. I don't think it's ever happened before. And if you've seen these TV shows like the MSNBC show called Lockdown on Prisons, it kind of gives you a chill. And I think actually there was, you know, this represents the kind of police power that we don't want to see happening in America. I mean, what was it? Yesterday, there were gunshots in Colorado into a crowd that was celebrating the legalization of medical marijuana, I guess. And were they going to lock down that city as they tried to find out who did that? I mean, you can easily imagine that the failure to be alert to the excesses of police power and authority, and there were quite a few of them, could, you know, in the current political environment and foreseeable future, could lead to locking down all kinds of big cities and tremendous constraints on people's freedoms. And in fact, you know, one other comment on this, don't want to go on and on about this, but, you know, it seems to me the people who helped resolve this fairly quickly were, in fact, the public out in the streets. They did some of the original videos. They were the ones who called and identified, the suspects when they were located. So I think one could make the argument that they might have solved this more quickly if there had not been a lockdown. But I guess I'm raising this just to say, in Boston, I've not seen a single public commentary or, you know, media piece that dealt with the problematic idea of locking down a whole city, which, to my knowledge, has never been done before.
I don't think it has either, Charlie. I simply can't remember it. Certainly wasn't done in Boston when I grew up there. I've lived in Chicago for over 40 years. The subject has never even come up. It's never even been hinted at. And Chicago police are notorious for being very, very tough. In a book I read years ago on police terrorism around the country, written long before 9/11, back in the 1980s, I think the book was written. A chapter it had on various cities, and it called Chicago the police repression capital of the country.
Yes.
I mean, just incredible, the stuff that goes on here. I've had some contact with people that have come in contact with the harshness of Chicago cops. You don't want to do it. But there's so many things about this story that bothers me, Charlie. I wrote four articles on it, put out a new one today. I'll get another one out tomorrow. It's almost like a mini 9/11 to me. We saw what happened post 9/11. We wage war, multiple imperial wars. We pass multiple repressive police state laws. I see more of this stuff coming. I mean, locking down Boston is one symptom, but it reflects the notion that if something bigger happens, my God, the Constitution can be suspended, martial law can be declared.
Right.
We can lock down the whole country.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the feeling, and I think that the narrative of, I mean, there was actually some restraint early on. There was, I mean, you know, John King on CNN had identified dark-skinned suspects, and he's been criticized because of the, you know, sort of racial implications, Muslim implications of that. But, you know, Boston was relatively restrained beyond the lockdown issue in terms of the Muslim thing. But the story that's being put together was the story that I was always feared would have really bad consequences for the country and for Obama's second term, which is that the older brother had returned to Russia, had been in touch with Chechen, violent, you know, gangs or terrorist groups that had originally been mainly focused on independence of Chechnya from Russia, but have had a, you know, increasing focus on an Al-Qaeda global Islamic struggle. So that the narrative of this whole, and in the Boston media over the last day or two, this part of the narrative is being built up, that the older brother really was in control, that he had gone back in 2012 to Russia, that he'd gotten involved with some form of Al-Qaeda, groups, that they had been very, you know, there were internet postings by the older brother and some by the younger brother that suggested they were being very strongly influenced by radical Islamic terrorist groups on the net and so forth. And so this was really my concern, that if this story became linked to Al-Qaeda or to radical Islam, it could be a tipping point in the second Obama second term, because it would re-evoke a lot of the post 9/11 dynamics. Given the kind of chaos in the Middle East right now, the situation in Syria, I mean, it's interesting that Kerry, the Secretary of State, just announced that the U.S. was beginning to build up supplies to the opposition in Syria, given the fact that the Israelis are putting time limits on Iran now that look more stringent than in the past, and so forth. It's really distressing, because it suggests that this thing could be part of a narrative, you know, a sort of a story about what's going on in the world, and create political pressures from the right on Obama. And he doesn't seem to need much political pressures. He's been pretty militaristic himself in regard to drones and so forth. That this could re-evoke the kind of, some version of the kind of political climate that we saw after 9/11, both in terms of foreign policy and what the U.S. might do in the Middle East, particularly if Israel decides to bomb Iran, but also in domestic effects. You know, I know the Muslim community here has been terrified. There's been growing reports of people, you know, sort of individual events in which Muslims are attacked. And then, you know, you've got to put it also in the context of the larger politics going on right now about guns and immigrants. This thing sort of bleeds into the debates going on around gun violence and immigration and so forth. And already in Washington, the Boston events have kind of led to much less hope that anything will happen on guns or perhaps even immigration, where people thought there was a better chance of something happening. So, yeah, I had always thought that it was possible that this was a domestic terrorist event, sort of like the Oklahoma City thing, which I thought would have far less adverse political consequences than something that might be able to be linked to Islamic terrorism. And, you know, my guess, we don't know yet, but my guess would be that these two very young guys were influenced by what they were reading on the net, but were not connected in any close way to Islamic terrorist groups. But nonetheless, this just that linkage is enough to lead to a lot of things we don't want to see happen.
Charlie, I absolutely believe. I don't know. I don't have the evidence one way or another. Let me put it this way. I strongly suspect, and I've certainly said it very, very strongly in the articles I've written, that these two young kids were set up as patsies. What on earth do they have to gain by setting off bombs at the finish line of the Boston Marathon or any place else? The only thing they could bring down on themselves is an enormous amount of grief. Nothing in the world could they gain from this. And the big question always when something like this happens is, Ki Bono, who gains from stuff like this? Well, we sure know who gained from the 9/11 attack. We know very, very well. And one of the big things for me, besides waging imperial wars, was declaring war on Islam. I wrote several times about it. In the article I'll put out tomorrow, I call America's War on Islam 2.0. Mm-hmm. I see the worse than ever for Muslims coming. They'll be vilified. They'll be demonized. I suspect there'll be more police state laws passed. There'll be the worst of things happening in the wake of this. And, of course, the media does what it always does. It hypes fear, fear-mongers. It follows the party line. Whatever the official statement is, that's what the media that I call the scoundrel media report. No fact-checking. I've got John King from CNN in my article tomorrow. Hyping the headline. I saw a bulletin of the video headline with breaking news. You know, stop the presses, breaking news. And then John King talking about, including mentioning dark-skinned suspects, before any official report came out. Well, CNN ended up for I don't know how many times with egg on its face. They weren't dark-skinned. And you look at the photos of these kids. You just look at them and you say, do these kids look like terrorists? Stories about them going back to Chechnya. I mean, they came over to America when they were young kids. The eldest one who was killed, his body riddled with bullets. The report was that he had an explosives vest on. Well, the hospital at Beth Israel Hospital said he was riddled with so many bullets from head to toe, it was impossible to tell what was the wound that killed him. Well, if he had an explosive vest on, Charlie, his body would have been ripped to pieces. It was intact, no limbs off, and I saw a photo on a website with him lying prone on the ground, his arms extended over his head. He wasn't bleeding. He obviously was trying to surrender. He had no weapon, no weapon in his hand, no weapon near him, and yet the police riddled his body with I don't know how many bullets, and I call that murder. And the other 19-year-old brother, God, his name is hard to pronounce. The elder brother is Tamerlan, and the younger brother, I'm not going to pronounce his name. It's just
too hard. Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce it either.
It's a tough name to pronounce.
Right.
But he must have been absolutely terrified. And his mother and father went on TV. His father on a TV service I hadn't heard about. I quoted his father in an article. His mother went on Russia Today, and they both basically said the same thing. I mean, these are good kids. They were set up. The FBI has been hounding them for years. They've been monitoring their emails, monitoring what websites they go to. I think there's been a scheme involved to set up various Muslims, and these two were picked for whatever, maybe because they're Muslim from Chechnya. And here we see these stories circulating, well, without hard proof that they're really is some kind of terrorist connection, they are innocent until proven guilty. But that's not the way the media portrays it. That's not the way the official story portrays it.
Right.
And I don't know again, Charlie, but I absolutely strongly suspect that these two kids were set up. One's dead. If the other survives, he'll be in prison for the rest of his life.
Well, I'm not willing to go quite in the direction you're going. I mean, I know that, for example, in 9/11, there were all these theories that the Bush administration actually, you know, incited 9/11, and in other words, actually committed the attacks and so forth. I think, from what I've read, it's very plausible that these two young guys, like a number of young kids in these kinds of situations, and you got to put this again in the context of the gun discussions domestically and how easy it is for young men in this country to get sucked into this kind of culture. I think it's possible what you're saying is correct, but I think that the evidence I'm seeing suggests that not that these guys were set up, but that the other side of it, the consequences of what was probably a very amateuristic and you know, not coordinated or highly organized event, you know, having very little to do with international terror, is going to be used for all the things that we've been talking about, for a more, you know, more drones, more interventionism in the Middle East, and pulling back on any effort to deal with really important domestic. I mean, it's kind of a, Obama had already sort of pulled back from what looked like when he gave his, you know, the difference between his State of the Union address and his inaugural was very, very pronounced, and he had already moved. In the inaugural, he put forward an agenda that looked like maybe, as in the last part of his campaign, when he began to give a little bit more of a populist and progressive, call. His inaugural, he talked about climate change. He talked about a range of important infrastructure and public investment issues. And then when he got to the State of the Union, just, you know, less than a week later, the address, some of his advisors had apparently persuaded him that he needed to once again, you know, conciliate the Republicans, and he dropped almost all of those things that he had talked about in the inaugural and put forward, you know, the grand bargain plan with Boehner and so forth. That it was as if he had forgotten that he won the election, you know, and he just gave the store away and began talking about cutting back on Social Security, you know, chain CPI and significant cuts in Medicare and Medicaid and so forth. So you already saw before these events, and we saw this, of course, in Illinois when he was representing Illinois, you know, his moving toward this very kind of centrist, central right sort of politics. Now I think what these events are doing is going to push him further in that direction, and just reinforcing his tendency to give so much ground on progressive, both domestic and foreign initiatives, that it is very discouraging. I mean, it's hard to see. I mean, even without these events, it was hard to see a very positive second term. And, you know, second-term presidencies, you don't have a lot of time to get things done. Now these events really have made it difficult. So I think, you know, we depend on the development of grassroots movements to sort of bring these things, you know, out into the public conversation. I mean, whether it's in independent media, whether it's various kinds of... here in Boston, we put together a you probably didn't hear about this, Steve, in Chicago, but it was significant. We put together a referendum in Massachusetts, which passed in the districts which were, you know, probably about half the districts in Massachusetts where it got on the ballot. This was in November. It was called Budget for All, and it argued for major public investment in, you know, clean infrastructure, no cuts to social programs, massive cuts in the military, and so forth. And it won overwhelmingly, you know, by 80% of votes in the districts where it carried. So we have examples of where people can organize at the state level, at the local level, and so forth, to try to counteract these national forces, which are, as I read them now, the tea leaves don't look all that promising. I mean, and I think that's the only thing we can do, is try to build up the progressive movements and forces that are going to provide some sort of countervailing weight to what the implications of these events are likely to be on the national level.
Charlie, I am absolutely scared to death. I mean, we know the horrors that followed 9/11,
right.
And now we've
right.
got this incident, and it's so easy to get the public terrified that you need to give up a little security,
right.
a little this, a little that, to protect the homeland. But we both know that you give up security, you give up everything. You're going to lose your freedom. You're going to see constitutional rights get eroded and absolutely trashed. One thing I want to get in, I noted a bulletin, I just checked it on the Financial Times. The headline is, Russian Militant Group Denies Boston Link.
This goes into
Chechnya, yeah. and it says, quote, the command of the Vilayet states that the Caucasian Mujahideen are not carrying out attacks against the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
They're not doing it. They're not thinking about doing it. They're not planning to do it. So if either of these brothers went back home for a visit, I don't know why they'd do it, because I'm not certain how well they remember it. They were so young when they came to America over 10 years ago. But if they went back, I can't imagine they would have had any contact with these kinds of people. And if they did, they certainly would not have been encouraged to carry out an attack in Boston or any place else. So I really think that's a red herring. That's just a terrible story, and I don't believe it. But what bothers me most is what will follow. And I have written so much about Obama, I think I could easily fill several books or more,
mm-hmm.
Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
His first three, I didn't do a year four review, but his first 3 years in office, I did a year in review at the end. I just went back and looked over things that I had covered through the year, and I just covered one issue after another. And you look at the policy initiatives that he stood behind. I mean, it is nightmarish. He literally exceeded the worst of George Bush. He did things that George Bush couldn't have done, and he's doing more things. He's attacking social programs that are just too important to violate in any way. Medicare, Social Security, he's going after Medicaid.
Right.
He's going after food stamps. Bush couldn't do these things, but Obama is doing it. He's in league with the Republicans, and many other Democrats are in league with him. When it comes to war, my God, I mean, we have a bipartisan consensus for war. And we saw what happened after 9/11. Will there be another target picked? Will there be another war waged? I mean, Obama is waging multiple direct wars now, multiple proxy wars. What else does he have in mind? And as far as cutting the military budget, Charlie, oh, I think it should be slashed. America spends more on the military, including Homeland Security, including all the expenses associated with the military and militarism, includes interest on the national debt, veterans benefits, black budgets, so much more than the rest of the world combined. And what do we do with this money? We wage war on humanity. And then Obama, I remember him saying it way, way back, I think in his first term, in terms of, comparing what we're doing to what we're able to do at home, the quote was, we're broke, quote
right,
unquote.
Right.
We're broke.
Well, you know, it's interesting, going back to the reaction to the lockdown idea. If Bush or a Republican had been in office, I think progressives would have been much, like I said, there's been no, literally not a single media There was a Daily Cost piece, I think, that was dealing with the civil liberties implication of the lockdown. But nothing in the Boston media whatsoever. Nothing. And imagine that Bush had been in office. I think there would have been much more awareness of the civil liberties and executive power issues and police state sort of imagery. And, you know, when you were talking about what you were just talking about, and which I raised earlier, Obama has, you know, Obama's election, I mean, I was very, given what the alternative was, it seemed like it was a blessing to have at least a finger in the dike. But, you know, when we're trying to cut, I mean, Obama is doing things now that may be facilitating, you know, well, let me put it this way. Resistance to, for example, cuts in the social budgets or cuts in defense spending are being hampered by the fact that the labor movement and other progressive movements are very torn because they don't want to oppose, they don't want to get into a position of looking like they're bringing down Obama or trying to pull down Obama. So the kinds of initiatives that if a Republican president were doing, you would have all-out progressive mobilization. You're seeing this around the budgetary issues. You know, we've been in connection with this budget for all thing I mentioned to you earlier. That had four provisions, which were approved overwhelmingly, but one was massive, you know, very substantial cuts in the military, and labor and some other progressive groups have been reluctant to do so, not just on traditional labor grounds that it will cut jobs, but because they've been reluctant to oppose Obama, which they would not be so reluctant. I mean, because the Labor Party is so tied into the Democratic Party. So there is this irony that Obama, despite all the sort of idealism that progressives sort of tied into him, and right here in Boston, in places you know, Steve, like Brookline and so forth, Newton liberal places, I'm talking to you from Newton, there is a reluctance of people to speak out about the kinds of issues you've been emphasizing and that I've been mentioning, simply out of concern that they don't want to tear down Obama. So, you know, this is the constant dilemma that the left and progressives are confronting, which is how do you mobilize a larger sector of the population for, you know, serious gun control, for the immigration rights, for massive action on climate change and on, you know, jobs. I mean, just to mention a few of the crucial issues. I mean, these are being constrained by Obama's unwillingness to really move the bully pulpit, and, you know, progressive people here in Massachusetts and around the country, their ambivalence and confusion about what to do in terms of these issues, given the fact that they don't want to see, they don't want to position themselves. Many of them love Obama, and they, despite his conservatism and their own liberalism or radicalism even, and they become more paralyzed. So it's ironic that Obama's presence as president is, I think, going to slow down the ability to get the really dramatic, decisive movements on the economy, on climate change, and the budget, on the whole imperial military operation. His presence may actually fuel this. And you know, this is something that I've also written a lot about when I talk about regime change and a lot of the other books that I've written over the last 5 to 10 years. You know, it's really about looking at how the Democratic Party has been. We really have sort of two parties of big business, one with a softer voice than the other, but which don't give the public any real You know, the majority of the public in America takes pretty strong stands on these issues. I mean, despite the fog about in the media about this, the truth is that on issues that range from corporate money in Washington to minimum wage to, you know, public investment on jobs to opposition to all this coddling of the big banks and so forth to military spending and so forth, there's an overwhelming public support of very progressive positions. And the Democratic Party has moved way to the right of that majoritarian position. So we're in a situation where you don't have any kind of substantive democracy operating because both parties are really funded by corporate money and shaped by corporate lobbying and, you know, the enormous pouring of money after Citizens United, just exacerbating all these long-term trends. And it's not like the country is not capable of supporting this. It's that we don't have a political system, in effect, right now that allows the majority position to be expressed.
So true, Charlie. The music means we need to take a break.
Right, I figured.
Yeah, hold your thought. I'll add a couple of my own when we come back. I agree with you. If people think Obama is a progressive, they better think again because he most certainly is not. Right. But we'll pick up on that and a lot more when we come back. Short break. Welcome back. Talking with Charles Derber, talking about events in Boston and related issues. So you really have to connect the dots, Charlie, and here's one dot to connect. Last week, in the aftermath of the Boston bombings, the House of Representatives passed CISPA, the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. I wrote several articles about CISPA, not recently, but what is CISPA? It lets it's really an alliance. It's a conspiracy between corporate America and government, Washington, that bypasses what remains of existing privacy laws so that they can spy on our communications, all of our communications, including online, pass personal data to the government. I mean, this stuff absolutely, as far as I'm concerned, is prohibited by the Constitution, but the Constitution doesn't matter anymore. So this bill, it not only passed the House, it passed by more than 2-1. I've got the numbers in front of me, 288-127. The bill goes to the Senate. I don't know what's going to happen there. I think it went down in the Senate last year, but there's momentum behind it because of the Boston incident. And again, you've got Democrats supporting this. I'm certain there'll be Democrat senators supporting it. Will there be enough to pass the bill? I don't know. Obama said before he'll veto it, but Obama's word isn't worth the paper it's written on, Charlie. He said so many times he would do A, and he ended up doing B. It would take the rest of the program to go into the most important ones. So, I mean, locking up U.S. citizens in military prisons when he said he'd never support anything like that. He not only supported it, he insisted on it when the Senate did not want to put it in the 2012 fiscal year, a National Defense Authorization Act. Well, Obama, they took it out. Obama insisted it be put back in again. And then it was put back in again. Well, it was in the 2013, I may have my fiscal years mixed up, 2013-14, the latest NDAA and the one preceding it. It's in the one preceding it. It's in the latest one where U.S. citizens, without any evidence, without any charges, can be indefinitely put in a military prison. This is what Obama wants.
Right.
No,
I think that there are sort of three big issues that I see. Many of them are essentially Obama perpetuating forces that were really coming to fruition under Bush. One is executive power, which is such, you know, which really is. I mean, remember the Bush period where progressives were all up in arms and, for every right reason, about the signing statements by Bush, which said that he was simply he would sign a law, but say he would not follow the parts of it that he didn't agree with, and that was tied into all this warrantless surveillance and some of the things you're beginning to talk about, where anybody suspected of terrorism, which it could be just anybody, could be could have their email or their phone or you know or their personal you know movements tracked without a court intervention, without any warrant, or there could be suspension of habeas corpus, as you're saying. So all these, I mean, I think this is what began with 9/11 and what the Boston event, unfortunately, could continue with this lockdown as being sort of the newest manifestation of this, of this enormous concentration of power that happens in ways that people regard as innocent, sort of, you know, and I think Obama contributes to that, that he puts a sheen on it, so that in Boston, for example, the lockdown was not viewed by, at least there was no collective expression of disquiet about it, you know, the idea of locking down an entire city. So I think this sort of concentration of executive power is incredibly important, and Obama has, as you've said, I mean, in the things you were just mentioning, there are many, many ways in which Obama is contributing to that trend. The second is the foreign policy direction, where, you know, the most recent stuff on what Kerry and Hagel have been saying about support for Israel makes me think that there is going to be, I mean, the fact that they're willing to keep getting more involved with Syria and the connections between Syria and Iran are so significant that it's just hard to imagine that within the next year there's not going to be some sort of military confrontation with Iran, which Obama is going to support. You might have noticed that they just put out a new economic and military support budget for Israel and other U.S. allies in the Middle East, which involve a lot of new arms and a lot of, you know, they're basically trying to buy off some sort of preemptive attack by Netanyahu against Iran. And so they're building up. Plus there are, I think, all kinds of interventions in the area around Syria and so forth that are, and perhaps in Iraq, that are going to lead up toward scary things going on in Iran over the next year. And then there's the domestic politics.
Can I throw in one thing?
Sure.
I've got two articles I'll put out tomorrow. One I mentioned, America's War on Islam 2.0, and the other one is titled Hagel in Israel, exactly what you're just talking about. Mm-hmm. Indeed, $10 billion in weapons. The number, I don't know whether the number means anything, but they're talking about all kinds of sophisticated things for Israel, Saudi Arabia, Arab Emirates. There may be another. I think those three countries. I think maybe Egypt. But Hagel is visiting five countries, and the discussion in my article that he's involved in, talking about Syria, talking about a possible attack on Iran, giving Israel a green light if Israel needs to do what it wants to do to defend itself. I mean, Israel has no enemies whatsoever except the ones it creates, just like America. But Israel claims it's threatened by Iran. Well, Israel is not threatened by Iran. That's an absolute red herring. Iran does not have an active military nuclear program. U.S. intelligence assessments say so every year. I quote Clapper, the intelligence, America's intelligence chief, testifying to Congress the middle of March, this past March, basically saying that there's no information that Iran has an ongoing nuclear weapons program. And they always throw in a tagline to the effect that, well, we don't know that they're not planning to do this. We just don't have any evidence to show that they're doing it. Well, you can bet your life, Charlie, if they had a program, America would certainly know an awful lot about it. It's the most heavily surveilled country in the world. And the U.S. 200 400 U.S. troops are either deployed on the Jordanian-Syrian border or they'll be deployed, including special forces, including intelligence types. NATO, several months ago, I quoted the head of NATO, Rasmussen, essentially saying they're looking for a pretext to get involved in the Syrian conflict. So I very much fear that this is coming. I very much fear the possibility of a war on Iran. I mean, we're talking about something that literally could explode to a regional war that could become a global war. It is no small threat. It's a real threat.
No, I think it's very real, given the domestic politics in Israel. And, you know, just thinking back, you know, the theme that we've been talking about in Boston and the whole issue of executive power, I'm sure you remember, Steve, back, I think about 10 years ago, when a guy named Bertram Gross wrote a book called Friendly Fascism.
Oh, yes.
And it sort of comes back. It often comes back in my reflections and my writing and so forth, because it's like the fact that there was absolutely, in a progressive city like Boston, absolutely no reaction to what was an unprecedented police sort of state shutdown on the whole city, and in fact on 12 cities. You know, the idea of friendly fascism, I think of it also when you think about the internal. I have a lot of people, friends, who live in Israel, and you've got a state which is incredibly intrusive, and, you know, where there are cameras everywhere, there's surveillance, there's, essentially a proto-fascist sort of political environment in the name of security in Israel. And it is a version of what Gross was writing about. He didn't write about Israel. He was writing about the United States. But, you know, you see the way in which the Israeli population, and after all, the Israeli population is made up of people who were European, you know, socialists a couple of generations ago and have that kind of progressive spirit in their genealogy, who have basically embraced this kind of militarized foreign and sort of proto-fascist domestic thing. And it makes me think about, you know, if Israel, and you have Israel with a kind of military Keynesian, you know, economy that's doing, you know, which is under stress, but is doing reasonably well. And you think of the analogies to the United States, which is, I think, very analogous, you know, that you have essentially a form of friendly fascism. That is, you know, executive power concentrations that began under Bush are continuing intensely under Obama, that are essentially being accepted without much contestation or fear by the population, and that makes, you know, that sort of goes all the way back to this idea that the United States is fundamentally a benign country, and therefore what we do domestically or foreign has to be good. This is sort of the way the British and even the Romans, you know, I mean, empires have always I did this book on the history of empires and looking at their moral discourse about themselves and how, you know, conquest, both in terms of foreign control and domestic control, the more severe and terrifying it is, the more moralistic the discourse and the political, you know, conversation in the country about the virtues of the nation. And you know, the British regarded themselves as bringing civilization and up to the savages and so forth. And the Romans had this idea of civilizational peace that the Roman Empire represented. And I think the U.S. and you know, the population, even while more educated and less knee-jerky than in right after 9/11 about a lot of this stuff, has basically acclimated itself to this kind of friendly fascist. You know, by that I mean this extreme concentration of surveillance, you know, shutting down of protest or restraining it in very extreme ways. I mean, now then getting to the point where people are being told to stay in their homes until further notice. All this stuff just has to be, I mean, I guess purpose of these kinds of programs that you do, of anybody who can write, I mean, you and I both spend a lot of time writing for media and books, and then organizing. I mean, you've really got to get people out on the streets. I mean, I don't think it's completely, I don't think, you know, one should take a completely pessimistic view about this, because I have to say, in Boston, despite the really bad things that we've talked about, there has been restraint in certain ways. You know, there has not been an all-out attack on Muslims. There has not been, or even legitimated discourse about that. The media is more careful. The public has been relatively restrained. There was a lot of generosity of spirit among people around the finish line of the marathon who dived right in to try to help people. So I think there's also been positive, and I think it's important to mark the reality that we're not simply reliving the worst part of 9/11. There have been some progressive changes, and they're obviously not far from deep enough, and there's really the dangers of all the things we've been talking about. But we got to ask, what are we going to build on? You know, what can we, and just to give you one example, my students here, I teach at Boston College, which is not a particularly, you know, liberal place, and there was a lot of talk about the importance, and in fact there was a plan by students, there are 112 campuses in Boston, to have a kind of, they were noting that the marathon, it has 96 countries, that it's a very international event and is sort of based on the premise of international solidarity. And they wanted to emphasize that by having a, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of students in Boston, having a march from one of the campuses, maybe here, Boston College, it's a 5-mile march to the finish line. It follows the track of the marathon. And it would really focus on international solidarity, you know, bringing together Muslims and Jews and Catholics and atheists and everybody, and then the international solidarity aspect. Now, the city shut that march down and did not allow it to take place, I think on Friday, as part of the lockdown, one of the many aspects of the lockdown that we should be concerned about. But, you know, students are still talking about some sort of march of this kind. And so it's a little bit like all these fights that we're involved with now. Like, I mean, the incredible tragedy of not doing any kind of gun legislation, or on the economic front, the cuts in the budget and so forth. I mean, there are progressive things going on. There is a substantial part of the population, a big majority, in fact, that would like to see a different direction, and just doesn't have any mainstream political vehicle for expressing these ideas. But so you're going to need, I mean, it was encouraging to me to see that students in the Boston area in large numbers are talking about this kind of march in solidarity. So I think we should give voice to the positive possibilities and some of the positive lessons, even as we should reinforce what we've been talking about mostly, which is the horrible possibilities that could emerge over the next 6 months to a year, you know.
Charlie, I remember so well post 9/11 that except for the I think virtual unanimous authorization for the use of military force for the Bush administration after 9/11 came, not too many days after the event. But the worst of it really began to unfold about a month later with the passage of the Patriot Act and the war on Afghanistan. They began in October, about 4 weeks after the event. So I think going forward, we need solidarity marches and everything that we can get. I absolutely agree on that, Charlie. But I fear that the worst of what will come will not unfold right away. It'll happen incrementally, and we'll see one thing happen, another thing happen, and that's exactly what happened after 9/11. So I think we'll just get add-ons to what happened then this time, and unless people understand how their freedoms are literally being destroyed in plain sight, and unless they do something about it, they're going to end up losing everything, and they won't realize how bad things could be until it's too late to do anything about
it. Well, I agree, and I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, we know that within 24 hours of 9/11, Cheney had said, this is, quote, as Seymour Hersh wrote in The New Yorker, our ticket to ride. And so they were within hours, literally, putting in place the war in Iraq, you know, even though they went after. And I agree with you that everything is in place, and we've talked about the building blocks, for some sort of incremental, over the next months and, you know, a couple of years, for disaster. There's no question about it. It's just the question I'm raising is, how do we mobilize? I mean, we have a very fragmented and demoralized liberal to left community, and we are not going to stop these events unless we find ways of expressing, you know, and people, the left tends to remain very fragmented, focusing on very, you know, very specific issues. I've been working hard, and there, I know there's sort of an awareness of this around the country, the importance of, given the kinds of crises that you've been emphasizing that I think are very real, that there has to be some sort of integration of all these progressive. I mean, there are a lot of progressive things going on around the country, a lot of local, and but the movements are very, you know, they're very fragmented. They don't want to spend very much time on each other's issues. If they're working on immigration, they don't want to work on, you know, gay marriage or you know, I mean, the issues are, it's very hard to get the labor movement to focus. They're fighting social cuts and for jobs, but they're not working on cuts in the military budget. So I think the work to be done is to try to bring out events that, the hope that I hold on to is there is a strong majority position in the country in support of a far more progressive agenda than we're likely to see. And so there is a foundation. You don't have to be sort of mushy or utopian to think that there could be a response to the kind of unfolding disaster scenarios that we're afraid of. But it's got to come out very quickly in mass actions of various kinds. There should be national responses going on. They ought to be at responses that bring together the labor movement, the climate movement. You know, you've seen visibility from the climate change movement. It's gained traction around a variety and visibility through civil disobedience around the Keystone pipeline and so forth. You know, the head of the AFL-CIO came out with very strong opposition to, you know, any cuts in the social Medicare, Social Security, and so forth. So, I mean, you know, it's sort of like there are building blocks in place, but they're just not consolidating and congealing, and people are demoralized and also paralyzed by the fear of bringing down Obama. So I think we need both things. We need a very vocal, incisive, forceful analysis of these disaster scenarios, which are very real. They're not, you know, they're not being imagined. I think all the crises that we're reflecting on here are very serious and very, you know, the probability of them is very significant. At the same time, we need to build up the whatever kinds of actions can be taken, educationally, in the media, and you know, on the streets, nationally and regionally, and locally, that give people a sense that people simply aren't going to accept this. You know, that there has to be a national reaction to this. And again, you know, this notion of friendly fascism, you know, I always have felt that the Weimar Republic period, which was the period in the 1920s when Germany, you know, went through this a massive economic crisis, and even though the far right was a tiny minority, just like the Tea Party is a tiny minority, because of the failures of left organization, you know, the crazy stuff that the socialist and communist parties in Germany were doing in the 20s, there was no ability of what was clearly a majoritarian left to, you know, I mean, it went from 1929 when Hitler was getting, you know, 2 or 3% of support in the German public to 30% by 30 or 31. And it really was caused by a failure of the left to mobilize itself to find a form of integration, to find an integrating vision. So, I mean, that's my kind of historical sort of guiding point to sort of help direct my own thinking, that we don't want to see a country which has a majority in support of these progressive things simply whipsawed into these police state reactions and the coming to power of a right-wing kind of imperial sort of proto-fascist kind of regime, which is very much visible right now. So
I absolutely agree with you, Charlie. I mean, the Democratic Weimar Republic became history, and Hitler replaced it. And in the early 1970s, Chile, under Allende, same thing happened. Chile was the most democratic country in South America.
Yes.
It disappeared, and we got Augusto Pinochet, a terrible tyrant, replacing him. And it can happen in America. And
it's funny you mentioned the Chile thing. I just want to mention that my first journalistic efforts were in Chile, because when I was like 23 years old, I was in that stadium where they were cutting off the hands. I had been in there in support of Allende, and when you know, the CIA coup took place, I saw the beginnings of that Pinochet dictatorship, and I saw the decimation. You remember there were all kinds of working class cooperatives being formed and working, and U.S. support of Chile, and then the Chicago Boys from Milton Friedman's gang and so forth went down there and joined forces with the Chilean government to bolster Pinochet's rule over the last 20 years, over the next 20 years. So yeah, that's a good image to go out on. You know, that we need to be very vigilant and remembering all, you know, whether it's the Weimar Republic or the fate of the Weimar or the fate of Allende and so forth. This is what we're up against, and we just have to be relentless in educating people and being out on the streets to try to respond to it.
Charlie, absolutely. We are out of time. I think it was Sinclair. I get Sinclair Lewis and Upton Sinclair mixed up. I think it's Sinclair Lewis who wrote many years ago, "It Can't Happen Here,"
right,
on emerging fascism in America. It was a novel,
right?
But it was a guy pretending to be a populist coming to power and literally going back on everything he promised and turning America into a fascist police state. Well,
right.
It can happen here. You can portray it in fiction, but it's happened around the world. It can happen in America. We can get the worst of it if people don't realize the possibility and do something about it. Charlie, this was a wonderful hour. I look forward to having you back.
Thanks. Enjoyed talking to you. Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you, Charlie.
Take
Join
care.
Us every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Weekends, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.
Bye-bye.